Good morning. Trump's blockade in the Middle East is in effect. As the conflict drags on, Politico assesses the growing fallout for the U.S. economy.
Time is not our friend here. Most folks, when this war started, thought that this was going to be a two-week endeavor and that traffic would resume relatively quickly.
Two congressmen call it quits on the same day, both over sexual misconduct allegations. NBC explains how threats of expulsion forced them out. And Trump faces rare criticism from his evangelical base as Pope Leo responds to his attacks. It's Tuesday, April 14th. I'm Cecilia Ley, and this is Apple News Today. President Trump's blockade of Iran's ports in the Strait of Hormuz is underway as of yesterday, marking a sharp escalation in the U.S. conflict with Tehran, one that, just days ago, had seemed to be cooling off. Confusingly, there now seems to be two blockades active in the all-important shipping route. Iran has stopped all ships from passing through, except its own or those from friendly countries, saying passage would only be permitted under Iranian control and subject to a fee. Now, the U.S. has said it's blocked that as well. Yesterday at the White House, Trump was asked about the blockade's goals.
What's the end game? Is it to force Iran back to the negotiating table? Is it to open up the strait so that gas prices ultimately come down?
Maybe everything. I mean, both of those things, certainly, and more. We can't let a country blackmail or extort the world.
There are still few details about how the blockade would work or how forcefully the U.S. would respond to any tankers in breach, but it could quickly heighten the conflict. New figures suggest Iran has still been exporting a lot of oil during the war. The regime has threatened retaliation if the U.S. tries to cut them off from that income. That could have wider consequences beyond the Middle East. China gets a lot of its oil from Iran, and if this blockade plays out as the administration has suggested, that would mean China could lose critical access. Trump said other countries would be involved, but several European leaders have ruled themselves out. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told the BBC they would be staying clear.
We're not supporting the blockade, and all of the marshalling diplomatically, politically, and capability, we do have minesweeping capability, I won't go into operational matters, but we do have that capability, that's all focused from our point of view on getting the straits fully open.
And others expressed bemusement. The EU's foreign policy chief said she wasn't even clear what the blockade amounted to, and Spain's defense minister said the move, quote, makes no sense. The two blockades set the stage for a test of which side can endure more economic pain, and we're getting a clear sense of how that pain is taking shape. Today, the International Monetary Fund will gather in Washington to offer an assessment of the global economic outlook, which, as we know, isn't so rosy. The IMF's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, issued a warning on Fox Business yesterday.
We are now facing this new shock. There are countries that are highly vulnerable to it because of this lack of capacity to respond and because they happen to be oil importers. Look, for the whole world, this shock matters. Why? Because it pushes prices up. So this pinch of higher prices is felt universally.
The U.S.'s status as a major oil exporter insulates it from the worst of the shocks. But there's no doubt that the pinch is starting to show up in data. Sam Sutton covers the economy for Politico.
Overall inflation has climbed quite a bit in the month of March, and that is not something that anybody really wants to see. On a monthly basis, the rate of inflation climbed by almost a full percentage point. We don't typically see spikes of that size.
Sutton added that core inflation, which doesn't include more volatile things like gas and food prices, remained relatively calm. The White House had said the price spikes will be temporary and that other goods were not being impacted as severely as gas. Sutton said that when it comes to resuming regular traffic in the Strait, time is of the essence.
I had a conversation on stage not too long ago with Gary Cohn, who worked at Goldman for a very, very long time and one of Trump's top advisors in the first term. And the way he described it is, these things get nonlinear the longer it goes. And what that means is that it's not like things get gradually worse. Things get much worse very, very quickly. We're not there yet. I don't think that we're anywhere close to there yet.
Just days before facing possible expulsion votes, two members of Congress announced yesterday that they were heading for the exits. Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell said that he would resign following accusations, including of sexual assault, that brought a swift end to his gubernatorial campaign in California. And Republican Representative Tony Gonzalez from Texas said he planned to retire after being investigated by the House Ethics Committee for sexual misconduct allegations. But their resignations came only after immense pressure from their colleagues.
Democrats, many of them, have argued that the allegations against Swalwell are serious and credible and consistent, that there's a pattern of behavior evident there. Same with Tony Gonzalez, that there is enough there that they have lost the trust of the public and they do not deserve to be representing 700,000 or more constituents in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Sahil Kapoor covers Capitol Hill for NBC News. Swalwell has denied the accusations against him, and Gonzalez acknowledged the affair with a staffer who later died by suicide.
Tony Gonzalez has been under investigation regarding ethics and has faced some calls from both Democrats and Republicans to step aside. He also faced the threat of expulsion, much like Swalwell. So as Congress was getting back into session this week, there was a high likelihood that both of these men would have faced votes in the House to get expelled, which would have been humiliating for both of them.
Two representatives, one Democrat and one Republican, had planned to introduce resolutions to expel Swalwell and Gonzalez with votes set for as early as Wednesday. As the drumbeat to oust them grew louder over the weekend, there was talk of lumping them in with an attempted expulsion of two other members who are both from Florida, Democrat Sheila Sherfalus McCormick and Republican Corey Mills. McCormick has already been found to have officially violated House ethic rules for allegedly using pandemic-era aid to fund her campaign. She denies those allegations. And Mills is being looked into by the committee as well for financial and sexual misconduct, among other issues. He's denied all wrongdoing. Expulsions in the House are rare. There have only been three since the Civil War, the last one being Republican George Santos, who was expelled in 2023. Kapoor told us Monday's resignations might have broader impact, especially as lawmakers face a packed legislative agenda.
Neither Swalwell nor Gonzalez has said when they are leaving. And it does have implications for the balance of power in the House because Republicans have this tiny majority, which could certainly come into play in major upcoming tasks such as DHS funding, funding for ICE and Border Patrol, as well as a major party line reconciliation bill, reauthorizing FISA Section 702. There's a lot that Congress has to do, and the margins really matter here.
Because it was unclear exactly when Gonzalez would leave office, the members that wanted to vote to expel him still said they intended to do so as of Monday night. Swalwell also didn't immediately specify when he plans to step down. The House is back in session today. As one military intervention spirals in unpredictable ways in the Middle East, another in South America has quietly faded from view. Trump frequently invokes the two in the same breath.
We have the strongest military in the world by far, and everybody sees it, whether it's Venezuela or what we've done with Iran.
But the two countries stand in sharp contrast. The January mission to capture Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro was quick and relatively efficient. Dozens were killed in the boat strikes leading up to the operation, and critics regard it as unjustified and illegal. But The Atlantic reports since then, life in Venezuela has mostly returned to normal, and recent polling from Bloomberg suggests citizens appear optimistic about the future. There's no sign of democratic reform, but while Iran's leadership remains steadfastly resistant to U.S. influence, Venezuela's interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, is said to be largely cooperating with U.S. demands, at least when it comes to oil. It may be too early to judge the success or failure of the operation in Latin America, but as the Wall Street Journal reports, businesses have already started thinking about whether it's time to put money back into Venezuela.
Venezuela is nowhere near where it used to be in the past, but the hope for many Venezuelans is that they'll be able to see a comeback this year.
Juan Ferrero is the South America Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He told us that mostly businesses have just been testing the waters without putting in much concrete investment. But the draw remains the country's enormous reserves of oil. And recent events have served as a reminder of just how valuable that can be.
That oil is just sitting there, ready to be mined and to be developed and exported. So that's a big draw. The other big draw right now is that companies see the U.S. as a backstop.
Since Maduro's removal, the National Assembly has instituted a series of reforms that offer favorable terms to investors. And in response, the U.S. Treasury has begun easing sanctions. The Trump administration operates tight control over oil revenues, and some European companies are announcing new deals.
Businesses want contracts to be sacrosanct for other companies or for governments to adhere by them, because the United States has, for one, recognized the interim government as the legal representative and as a legitimate government of Venezuela. The two governments are working closely. They're partnering. And so that's a big step forward for these companies and positive news for them.
But investing in Venezuela is a risky bet. Its political future is uncertain, and the country is still led by a government with a track record of clamping down on businesses and its own people. One Venezuelan risk analyst told the Journal that the nation's opaque bureaucracy and capital controls could create issues for companies that are cautious of violating sanctions. The U.S. hasn't ended sanctions against state companies, but it has provided licenses and waivers so that American firms, primarily in oil, can do business in Venezuela.
When a country like Venezuela collapses, I mean, it was a near collapse, 80% of an economic contraction over a period of decade, then it has nowhere to go but up. And the economic growth there and potential for revenues is pretty high, the potential. And that's what investors see, because it's a country that's basically seen as a country that is reconstructing, rebuilding from the depths that it reached. So the earnings would be great.
Trump has promised $100 billion of investment, but that remains a long way off for now. And it's still unknown when Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Prize-winning opposition leader, will return to Venezuela, though her allies in the country say that may be soon. And finally, here are some other stories we're following. A man suspected of throwing a Molotov cocktail at the house of OpenAI CEO Sam Altman is facing charges, including attempted murder. 20-year-old Daniel Moreno Gama is accused of traveling from Spring, Texas to San Francisco to target the tech boss's home. Police said an exterior gate caught on fire, but no one was hurt. According to a filed complaint, police recovered a document in his possession that detailed his intentions to kill Altman and warned of humanity's, quote, impending extinction due to AI. If convicted of the state charges, Moreno Gama could face 19 years to life in prison. And tensions between the president and the Pope boiled over yesterday after Trump posted an AI-generated image of himself as a Jesus-like figure to social media. The post generated a lot of criticism, and he eventually took it down, though he didn't apologize. Instead, he said it was a misunderstanding.
I did post it, and I thought it was me as a doctor and had to do with Red Cross as a Red Cross worker there, which we support, and only the fake news could come up with that one.
He also criticized Pope Leo more directly. He described him as weak on crime and, quote, terrible on foreign policy, among other things. The pontiff responded while speaking to reporters on a plane on Monday as he began a tour of Africa. He said he wouldn't get into a debate with Trump, but also wouldn't stop speaking out on issues of war and peace.
I have no fear, neither the Trump administration nor speaking out loudly about the message of the gospel. And that's what I believe I am called to do, what the church is called to do. We're not politicians. We're not looking to make foreign policy, as he calls it, with the same perspective that he might understand it.
Trump's posts are often controversial, but criticism here came from some unlikely parties. Christian evangelical leaders called for Trump to withdraw his remarks, while Giorgia Meloni, the Italian prime minister, usually aligned with Trump, called the comments unacceptable. Pope Leo has become increasingly outspoken. Without citing Trump or the U.S. specifically, the Pope said, enough of the display of power, enough of war. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Vanity Fair takes a look back at a historic Los Angeles jewel heist and speaks to a resident of the home who was there that night 65 years ago. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.